No simulation had even hinted at the violence of this ride. In the post-flight debriefing, Anders would say only that he was impressed by the Saturn's very positive control. But in reality, he felt as if he were helpless prey in the mouth of a giant, angry dog. After all those simulations, if the first 10 seconds were this different, what would the rest of the flight be like? Long seconds passed in thunder while the rocket climbed its own length and still higher. Borman's crew barely heard Prophet shout, "Tower clear!" The danger of collision with the launch tower passed. They kept climbing. Now the rocket turned and headed into its programmed flight path. "Roll and pitch program," called Borman, his voice shaking with the vibrations of the ride. Meanwhile, the Cape Launch Center yielded command to Mission Control in Houston, where Mike Collins was serving as Capcom. If the booster suddenly went berserk and Mission Control ordered an abort, it would be Collins who would relay the command. But inside Apollo 8, the Saturn's roar was so loud that Borman's crew would not have heard him, and they could no longer hear each other. They were no longer a crew, but 3 passengers riding in a fury of sound. Just 40 seconds after liftoff, the Saturn went supersonic, and the ride smoothed out. Now there was quiet again. In Apollo 8's left seat, Borman kept a watchful eye on the trajectory readouts. If at any point the Saturn should turn angry, he would be able to whisk them away from it by twisting the abort handle, setting off the escape rocket. But the beast was behaving itself beautifully, and from Houston, Mike Collins's message of reassurance came through loud and clear. "Apollo 8, you're looking good." The Saturn tore through the atmosphere on a great bonfire column of light, hundreds of feet long. Under the command of its own gyroscopic brain, the booster arced slowly over until it was almost horizontal, following the curve of the Earth, picking up speed and receding into a deep blue sky. As the rocket penetrated the rarefied upper atmosphere, the exhaust fanned out into a broad plume of golden flame. In the command module, Borman and his crew scanned the instruments and felt the mounting force of acceleration as the massive load of fuel in the first stage was consumed. Soon their chests began to flatten. The G-meter registered 3 times the force of gravity, now 4, and was still climbing. Their arms were leaden. Then, just as the G-meter hit 4.5, the forces of acceleration abruptly vanished as the first stage shut down on schedule. At that moment, the men could have been sitting on a catapult. They flew forward against their straps with tremendous momentum. Anders was sure he would go right through the instrument panel, but their harnesses held them firmly. Borman felt the sudden jarring and thought warily of the stress placed on the booster. Suddenly, right on schedule, there was a muffled bang as jets of smoke and flame heralded the departure of the now unneeded emergency escape rocket, taking the boost protective cover along with it. Daylight streamed into the cabin as the command module's windows were uncovered. For a stolen moment, rookie Anders glimpsed a view available only to the space traveler, a vivid, bright arc of ocean and clouds against a darkening sky. 5 minutes into the flight now, it was amazingly quiet. The G-forces had lessened, and there were more welcome words from Mike Collins. "Apollo 8, your trajectory and guidance are go." "Thank you, Michael," said Borman, sounding pleased. Apollo 8 sped out of the last fringes of the atmosphere, picking up speed. Now 7 minutes. At about 8 minutes, a rapid vibration set in, the same kind that had rattled the previous Saturn V to the point of malfunction. Thankfully, it did not build beyond a mild shaking, but Borman was relieved when the second stage shut down and fell earthward, its work done. At 8:45, the third stage kicked in with a mild jolt and chugged along, getting up the last bit of velocity until 11.5 minutes after liftoff, it too fell silent. Apollo 8 was in orbit. 115 miles up, circling the Earth at a speed of more than 17,400 miles per hour, Apollo 8 moved in that exquisite balance between gravity and momentum called orbit. Had they done nothing, Borman, Lovell, and Anders would have remained there for days, slowed only by friction with the scant upper atmosphere. The bold difference in this flight was set for just 2.5 hours from now, late in their second orbit. At that time, they would reignite the third stage engine for a little over 5 minutes and tip the balance between gravity and momentum enough for Apollo 8 to leave Earth orbit and reach the moon's gravitational sphere of influence, and that was what Borman lay awake worrying about.
"I don't want to see you looking out the window,"
Borman's voice. They had a timeline to stick to. Anders knew that, as well as his commander. But to be in orbit for the first time and not look outside, that was easy for Borman to say. He and Lovell had been here before. Once or twice, when Borman wasn't watching, Anders stole glimpses of the Earth, a magnificent panorama of color and bright clarity that filled his window. Brilliant white plumes and swirls of cloud crisscrossed land and ocean. Entire continents swept past in minutes. Somewhere over the midnight Earth, was it New Zealand? Lightning glowed in the clouds far below like flash bulbs going off under wads of cotton. And when they came over the coast of California, he spotted San Diego, the scene of his childhood explorations of hills and rabbit trails. He wanted to linger here, taking in the ever-changing beauty of his home. Anders wished they weren't going to the moon. Not yet. But the time flew by. There was a small mishap when Lovell, under one of the couches to adjust a valve, accidentally inflated the life vest attached to his spacesuit. He would always remember the disgusted look on Borman's face. But aside from that, everything went like clockwork. What so many had doubted, including Borman, was actually happening. Apollo 8 was checking out perfectly. And at last came the word the three astronauts had been waiting for, and ironically, it came from the man originally slated for Apollo 8's center seat, Mike Collins. One of the most momentous directives ever given, it was spoken with remarkable calm and in the coded language of space flight. "Apollo 8, you are go for TLI." As Apollo 8 drifted through darkness over the Pacific, the last minutes ticked by until the scheduled ignition of the third stage. If everything went as planned, Borman and his crew would be mere passengers while the computer did the work. With 10 seconds to go until ignition, the computer gave a coded message to the astronauts, a flashing number 99. Translated, it said, "Are you sure you want to do this?" Lovell answered by pushing the button marked "Proceed." And moments later, at mission elapsed time, 2 hours, 47 minutes, and 37 seconds, the third stage rocket came to life with a long, gentle push. This time, the ride really did feel like the simulator. The men sank into their couches with barely more than the force of normal gravity. Immediately they sensed the rocket veering to one side as it headed out of Earth orbit and onto a course for the moon. Trajectory specialists in Houston hawk-eyed the moon ship's path and sent word via Mike Collins, "You're looking good here, right down the old center line." Borman kept his eye on the attitude indicator, ready to take over steering if the booster's automatic system failed. Anders monitored the pressures and temperatures in the fuel tanks, and Lovell called out their ever-increasing speed from the computer readout. The numbers galloped upward, 30,000 feet per second, now 33,000, and finally 35,532 feet per second, some 24,226 miles per hour, the speed necessary to reach the moon on a free return path. At that instant, 5 minutes and 18 seconds after ignition, the computer shut down the engine automatically. Apollo 8 was on its way to the moon. From Mission Control, Collins had good news for the departing moon voyagers. "We have a whole room full of people that say you look good." And one of those people was Chris Kraft, sitting in the back row of the control room. Kraft rarely came on the radio during a mission, and Borman was surprised to hear his exultant send-off. "You're on your way. You're really on your way now." Still, inside the command module, there was nothing to convey this departure to the senses. No sensation of speed whatsoever, just numbers on the computer. That changed dramatically when Borman cut loose from the spent third-stage booster, pulled away with a burst from the service module's small maneuvering thrusters, and spun Apollo 8 around. At first, the sight of the third stage itself, a hulking cylinder aglow in the unfiltered sunlight of space, caught their attention. But then, as the spacecraft turned, Borman's crew could see the place they left behind. Not a landscape, but a planet, a luminous sphere whose roundness was apparent to the eye. Apollo 8 was departing at such fantastic speed that the men could see their world receding from them almost as they watched. Already the entire globe fit neatly within the round window of the command module's side hatch. Whatever names humans gave their Earth, it deserved to be called the Blue Planet, for its dominant aspect was the vivid, deep blue of oceans. In striking contrast were the clouds, brilliant white flecks and streamers that embraced the globe, swirling along coastlines and across oceans. Where land masses peeked through, the vivid oranges and tans of the deserts were easy to spot. More elusive were the jungles and temperate zones, because their verdant hues did not easily penetrate the atmosphere. They showed up as a bluish-gray with only a hint of green. And everywhere, beyond the planet's bright curved edge, a blackness so deep as to be unimaginable. Right now, though, it wasn't time to look at the Earth. Borman was more concerned about the cast-off third stage. As the flight plan called for, Borman had pulled up within a few dozen yards of the booster to demonstrate the maneuvers that future crews would use to extract a lunar module from its berth. But Borman, anxious to save fuel and to avoid any maneuvers that would affect their trajectory, did not want to prolong the exercise. Furthermore, he knew the booster was scheduled to blow off its excess fuel sometime in the near future, and when that happened, it would be better not to be anywhere nearby. All he wanted to do was get away from it. After conferring with Mission Control, Borman pulsed the hand controller and fired the maneuvering thrusters to pull away. But the third stage seemed to be following them. Already it was spewing fans of brilliant ice particles into space, reminding Borman of a huge lawn sprinkler. For the better part of an hour, Borman made anxious queries to Houston on how to get away without disturbing the free return trajectory. Lovell's attempts to realign the command module's navigation platform were to no avail. The sky was full of false stars from the booster, and it was impossible to find any real ones. And right now, the best landmark in this dark, sunlit ocean, the Earth, was out of view. When Collins in Mission Control outlined a small evasive maneuver, Borman replied, "Okay, as soon as we find the Earth, we'll do it." In Mission Control, Borman's words triggered brief, amazed laughter. Finally, after more than an hour, Anders saw the world drift into his right-hand window, and after more deliberations with Houston, Borman fired the maneuvering thrusters once more. Slowly, the third stage dwindled until it was just a bright star. And Apollo 8 was alone in the translunar void. "Would you pass me the flight plan, Bill?" Anders reached for the three-ring book floating in the air next to him. He gave the book a gentle push, and it drifted across the cabin into Lovell's open hand. Apollo 8 was coasting moonward like a baseball fleeing the strike of the bat, and everything inside it, including the three astronauts, was weightless. There was a moment, back in Earth orbit, when he unbuckled his harness and his body hung literally in midair, suspended above his couch. For years he'd heard other astronauts talk about zero-G, but there was no way to anticipate it. No simulation could have prepared him. In the first few hours of the mission, there was no time to enjoy this strange new world. But sometime after TLI, well on the way to the moon, Anders climbed out of his spacesuit and found a freedom unlike any he had ever experienced. Wearing only a pair of beta-cloth coveralls over his long johns, he floated unencumbered. Suddenly, the cramped cabin seemed to grow roomy. With a push of a fingertip against his couch, he propelled himself slowly past the instrument panel into the open area they called the lower equipment bay, which housed storage lockers and Lovell's navigation telescopes. There he found enough room to stretch out, or to hang inverted, with his feet up by the top hatch and his head pointing at the floor. Up and down were whatever he wanted them to be. He could even float underneath the seats, among coolant pipes and storage compartments. The command module seemed to have suddenly doubled in size, and in zero-G it became a wonderland. Water formed perfect, shimmering, dancing spheres. Cameras twirled and tumbled with the touch of a fingertip, or lingered in mid-air when not in use. This was a world of action and reaction, a three-dimensional ice rink. There wasn't room for gymnastics, but in the lower equipment bay, Anders had enough space to tuck his body into a ball. A nudge against the wall set him tumbling like an acrobat magically suspended at the top of his arc. It would have been great fun, but for one thing. It was making him ill. Suddenly, in the midst of his acrobatics, Anders felt a wave of nausea come over him. For years, the NASA doctors had worried about motion sickness in space, fearing that zero-G would confuse the inner ear, which gives the body its sense of up and down. But no astronaut had ever returned from orbit with anything but glowing enthusiasm for weightlessness. Borman and Lovell, for example, had spent 2 weeks in freefall with no ill effects. But the command module had something that the phone booth-sized Gemini didn't: room to move. The doctors feared that simply by floating around, an astronaut would push his vestibular system over the edge. Still, Shiraz's crew came back from Apollo 7 with no complaints. Maybe it came down to the individual, and there was no way of knowing who would be sick and who wouldn't. The only thing Anders knew was that he needed to be still for a while. Soon he felt better. Several hours later, Anders not only wasn't sick, he was so comfortable that he felt as if he had always been weightless. But one aspect of weightlessness was so unpleasant that even the thrill of exploration didn't make up for it. If this marvel of engineering called Apollo had one major design flaw, it was the waste management system, perhaps the most euphemistic use of English ever recorded. For urine collection, there was a hose with a condom-like fitting at one end which led, by way of a valve, to a vent on the side of the spacecraft. On paper, at least, it seemed like a reasonable, if low-tech, way to handle urinating in zero-G, assuming you got over your anxiety about connecting your private parts to the vacuum of space. You roll on the condom, open the valve, and it all goes into the void where it freezes into droplets of ice that are iridescent in the sunlight. One astronaut answered the question, "What's the most beautiful sight you saw in space?" with, "Urine dump at sunset." In reality, using the urine collector didn't work out so well. For one thing, it could be painful. If you opened the valve too soon, some part of the mechanism was liable to poke into the end of your penis, which tended to prevent you from urinating. And at that point, as if to confirm your worst fears, the suction began to pull you in. Now you were being jabbed and pulled at the same time, so you shut off the valve, and as the mechanism resealed itself, it caught a little piece of you in it. It only took one episode like that to convince you not to let it happen again. Next time you had a strategy, start flowing a split second before you turn on the valve. But once you began to urinate, the condom popped off, and out came a flurry of little golden droplets at play in the wonderland, floating around and making your misfortune everyone's misfortune, and in no time the whole device reeked. It was an affront to the senses just sitting there. Anders got used to the urine collector, though, and he got used to mopping up afterwards. But there was no getting used to the other part of the waste management system. Tucked away in a storage locker was a supply of special plastic bags, each of which resembled a top hat with an adhesive coating on the brim. Each bag had a kind of finger-shaped pocket built into the side of it. When the call came, you had to flypaper this thing to your rear end, and then you were supposed to reach in there with your finger. After all, nothing falls, and suddenly you were wishing you'd never left home, and after you had it in the bag, so to speak, you had one last delightful task: break open a capsule of blue germicide, seal it up in the bag, and knead the contents to make sure they were fully mixed. At best, the whole operation was an ordeal. In the confined space of the command module, your crewmates suffered too. One of the Apollo 7 astronauts said the smell was so bad it woke him up out of a deep sleep. When Shearer's crew came back, they wrote a memo about it. Get naked, allow an hour, have plenty of tissues handy. Anders saw the memo and heard the stories, and before the mission, he decided he was going to do everything in his power to avoid it. The food on Apollo 8 was specially formulated to produce as little residue as possible, but Anders wasn't taking any chances. He started his own low-residue diet a few days before launch. 6 days was a long time, but he was determined. He'd go all the way to the moon and back on Lomatil, if he had to. The hours passed in steady activity. By noon, Houston time, some 5 hours into the flight, all three men had doffed their bulky spacesuits and stowed them underneath the couches. Around 1 p.m., Lovell began taking star sightings for navigation, and there were more tasks into the afternoon. Replace an air filtration canister, look after a battery, service a power-producing fuel cell. At 6 p.m., the astronauts made the first brief firing of the service module's SPS engine, though it lasted only 2 seconds. The engine slammed Borman's crew back into their couches, then released them. It was enough to correct Apollo 8's path after Borman's earlier maneuvers to get away from the third stage. Just as important for engineers in Houston, the firing gave a crucial look at the engine's performance in space. The SPS passed its first brief test with flying colors. By then, more than 11 hours had passed since launch, and aboard Apollo 8, it was getting to be a long day. It was time for Borman to get some sleep. The flight plan called for at least one man to be awake at all times to keep an eye on the spacecraft and maintain contact with Houston. For now, Lovell and Anders would stand watch while Borman slept. As he floated into the sleeping bag attached to the underside of his couch, Borman was more than ready for a rest, but his mind would not cooperate. It wasn't easy to just turn off the mission and fall asleep. 2 hours later, still keyed up, he called down to Houston and got permission to dig out the medical kit and take a Secanol. He hated pills, but it was more important that he rest. 9 p.m., Houston time. 14 hours mission elapsed time, 77,000 miles out. Already, a bit more than 11 hours after translunar injection, Apollo 8 was a third of the way to the moon. But even as Borman, Lovell, and Anders sped moonward, the Earth tried to pull them back, slowing their flight. It was as if the moon ship were coasting up a hill, one that became less and less steep as it went along. About 2 days from now, on the afternoon of December 23rd, Apollo 8 would reach the gentle crest of that hill, the place where the Earth's gravitational influence gave way to the moon's. From then on, it would begin falling toward its destination. For now, though, there was no sense of speed, or for that matter, any normal sense of time. To Borman's crew, time was told by the mission clock on the instrument panel. Their wristwatches were still set to Houston time, but all vestiges of day and night had vanished. They moved in the unrelenting glare of an unfiltered sun in a black sky. To keep the sun's heat and the frigid cold of space evenly distributed on the hull, Borman had set the spacecraft rotating slowly on its axis, making one full turn in an hour. The astronauts nicknamed this the barbecue mode. Every once in a while, as the craft turned, the men caught sight of the Earth. With each passing hour, it dwindled. They couldn't see the change as they watched, but if they turned away from it and looked again later, they noticed that it was a little smaller and more distant. Presently, it was about the size of a baseball held at arm's length. At least now Anders could tell what he was looking at. It hadn't been so easy a few hours ago, when the planet still loomed big and bright. Back then, fresh out of his spacesuit, Anders had his first chance to savor the view, and to his embarrassment, he couldn't tell what in the world he was looking at. As a kid, he'd prided himself on being something of a geography expert. He knew every country and major city on the schoolroom globe, but the real Earth wasn't like the schoolroom globe. It had clouds, for one thing, and the countries weren't different colors. No small detail. A large landmass peaked from beneath the clouds. Was that Africa? He could just about make out the bulge of the Sahara, the point of Cape Town. Wait a minute, he thought, that doesn't make any sense. If that's Africa, then where is South America? And what is that thing out in the middle of the Pacific? It was time to go back to basics. There was a big white patch near the edge. It had to be ice or clouds. Anders thought it looked more like ice. Winter in the northern hemisphere, and there's a big patch of ice in sunlight. That had to be Antarctica. But how could that be right when it was at the top? Then he realized, because we're upside down. Anders turned himself until the white patch was at the bottom, and suddenly everything fell into place. There was the great South Polar ice cap. Above it, not the Horn of Africa, but the coast of Chile, and all of South America, from rainforest to coastal desert, wrapped in clouds. North America hid beneath a winter overcast, but he could spot the Florida Peninsula under clear skies. In the Maritimes, a cyclone's brilliant white pinwheel sprawled across the Atlantic, and in the Caribbean, the shallow waters of the Bahamas gleamed like a turquoise jewel lit from within. He would be able to spot it all the way out to the moon. He wished he could spin the planet around on its axis and see the rest of it. But it turned at its own pace, just as it always had. Sunday, December 22nd, 1 a.m., Houston time. 18 hours mission elapsed time. Borman awoke after about 5 hours of fitful sleep. He didn't feel well. He told Lovell and Anders he had a headache and took a couple of aspirin. Then he just floated in his couch and watched the instrument panel. A few minutes went by, and the next thing Lovell and Anders knew, he was retching. Anders handed him a plastic bag, and Borman went down into the lower equipment bay and threw up. Lovell flashed Anders a knowing look. Borman must be motion sick. The episode was beginning to make Anders feel a bit sick himself, when suddenly he spotted a greenish sphere, about the size of a tennis ball, ascending slowly out of the equipment bay in a flurry of tiny bits and globules. The sight of it made him want to gag, but when it drifted closer, he noticed that the blob was shimmering and pulsating in three directions at once, in some kind of complex fluid vibration made possible in zero gravity. At that moment, the scientist in him took over. He was about to go for a camera when suddenly the blob split in two. As if to affirm Newton's laws of motion, the twin spawns headed away from each other in exactly opposite directions, giving Anders a flash of recognition. Conservation of momentum. One scooted away whence it had come, and the other headed right for Lovell. The man was cornered. The blob hit him on the chest and then, overcome by the forces of surface tension, spread out on his coveralls as flat as a fried egg. By now, a horrible stench had rolled out of the equipment bay. Anders left Lovell to his predicament and reached for an oxygen bottle on the wall of the cabin, meant to be used in case there was a fire. To hell with that, Anders thought. He slapped the mask on his face and turned it on full. Meanwhile, Borman's troubles weren't over. Now he was struck with diarrhea. What a mess. Lovell and Anders had to help chase down stray bits of vomit and feces with paper towels. In a strange, detached way, Anders was reminded of hunting butterflies. Anders floated in his sleeping bag, eyes closed, trying to relax. He was tired. Before now, he would have thought that sleeping on a bed of air would have been the best imaginable, but it wasn't working out that way. Like Borman, he found it difficult to take his mind off the flight. He missed the pressure of a pillow against his head and the security of a blanket drawn up around him. The bag was clearly designed for someone as big as Lovell. Anders was bouncing around inside it like a lone pea in a pod. He steadied himself and tried to lay still. Every now and then a residual bit of vomit drifted by and he cowered, and he noticed that his body had not fully adapted to zero-G. His heart, accustomed to a lifetime of fighting gravity, was suddenly too strong. As a result, he heard a muffled, incessant boom, 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 his own blood pulsing in his ears. And each time he was about to fall asleep, he was startled awake by the sensation of falling, just like the feeling he'd had in dreams on Earth. His central nervous system seemed to be broadcasting an alarm, telling him what he already knew, that he was in an environment unlike anything he had ever known. 8 a.m. Houston time, 1 day, 1 hour mission elapsed time. 120,000 miles out. When Anders awoke, he did manage a few hours of fitful sleep. He found Borman much recovered, blaming his illness on a 24-hour virus. Anders suggested he reveal the incident to Mission Control, but Borman replied, "I'll be damned if I'm going to tell the whole world I had the flu." Anders finally convinced his commander to put a short summary on tape. The message could be sent to Earth via a special telemetry channel. That way no one would hear except the few managers who listened to the tape. "I'll go ahead and dump this," Anders radioed Houston. He couldn't come out and say what was on the tape, but he had to find some way of getting them to listen to it soon. He suggested, "You might want to listen to it in real time to evaluate the voice." Then there was nothing to do but wait for a response. Hours went by with no word from Earth about the message. Eventually, Anders found out why. It was hours before the flight controllers even had a chance to hear it. So much for putting messages on tape, Anders thought. Finally, at 1 day, 4 hours mission elapsed time, Mike Collins called up on a special frequency. "Apollo 8, this is Houston. We're on a private loop right now, and we'd like to get some amplifying details on your medical problems. Could you go back to the beginning?" "Mike, this is Frank. I'm feeling a lot better now. I think I had a case of the 24-hour flu." Borman recapped the whole episode for Collins, and to Borman's surprise, Chuck Berry came on the line to talk to him directly. That almost never happened. Unbeknownst to Borman, the episode had triggered serious talk of canceling the mission. Berry worried that Borman had a virus and that it was only a matter of time before his crewmates caught it. But Borman told the Earthbound flight surgeon that he felt much better and that neither Lovell nor Anders had been affected. "We're all fine," he said. Minutes later, in consultation with Berry and other managers, Apollo Program Director Sam Phillips decided to let the flight continue. Even if Phillips had decided otherwise, Apollo 8 was too far away for the SPS to manage a swift about-face maneuver. Borman, Lovell, and Anders were committed now. Even if they had to abort their mission, they were going to go around the moon. 2:01 p.m. Houston time, 1 day, 7 hours, 10 minutes mission elapsed time, 140,000 miles out. "Are you receiving television now?" "Apollo 8, Houston, we just got it." "You are getting it?" "Okay, Apollo 8, we have a good picture." Frank Borman had fought to keep the small television camera off Apollo 8. He wanted neither its added weight nor the demands on his time, but he had lost that battle. And just now, as he conversed with Capcom Ken Mattingly, the big screen at the front of Mission Control flickered to life, and there was Jim Lovell, apparently upside down, at the navigation station, making star sightings and making lunch. The picture was fuzzy, and it was in stark black and white, but to many who saw the brief telecast on the afternoon of December 22nd, it seemed a small miracle, a live glimpse inside a moon-bound spaceship. For this first telecast from Apollo 8, Anders handled the camera while Borman narrated. "Jim, what are you doing here?" "Jim is fixing dessert. He's making up a bag of chocolate pudding. You can see it come floating by." The narrow bag tumbled in the middle of the cabin. To the astronauts, it was natural to see such things, but Anders had to wonder, how must it look to those who were watching? There were people who didn't believe Apollo 8 was real to begin with, that it was all a hoax perpetrated by the government. And it crossed Anders's mind that live television of three men floating inside a spaceship was as close to proof as they might get. The irony was that apart from the weightlessness and the view, it was pretty hard to convince himself that this was really happening. For one thing, they didn't seem to be going anywhere. That was the paradox of this flight, faster and farther than anyone had ever gone, with no sense of motion. They might as well have been in the simulator, and yet they were more than 140,000 miles from home. They could hear the distance in every conversation with Mission Control, the pause between question and answer, while radio signals spanned enormous distance. This transmission is coming to you approximately halfway between the moon and the Earth, Borman continued. We have about less than 40 hours to go to the moon. I certainly wish we could show you the Earth. Very, very beautiful. Unfortunately, that attempt failed. When they turned the camera on the brilliant blue and white planet, Houston reported only an unintelligible blob of light. Now Borman trained the camera on Anders. You can see that he has his toothbrush here. He's been brushing regularly. Anders twirled the toothbrush, and it spun magically in the air in front of him until he snatched it back. It looks like he plays for the Astros, the way he tries to catch those things. The Astros hadn't been doing well. Hey, Frank, how about a couple of words on your health for the wide world? Deke Slayton's voice. Slayton rarely came on the air, but the illness had caused a big flap in Houston and had made it into the news, and now was the chance to show the world that the crisis had passed. Inside Apollo 8, Borman smiled and waved at the camera. We all feel fine, he said. Only 14 minutes after the telecast began, it was time to end it. Borman would now set the spacecraft back on its slow, thermal control spin, and that meant the high-gain antenna could no longer track the Earth. Before they signed off, Lovell ducked into view. He wanted his mother to get a good look at him. Today was her 73rd birthday. Lovell looked at the camera and grinned. Happy birthday, Mother, he said. Monday, December 23rd, 6 a.m., Houston time. 1 day, 23 hours mission elapsed time. 187,000 miles out. Bill Anders was alone on watch, floating in Borman's seat on the left-hand side of the cabin. The flight was turning out to be somewhat different than he'd imagined. He had never expected to be bored. Make sure it works, Borman had told him, but everything was working just fine without him. He found himself wishing that something would go wrong so he would have a chance to fix it. Not that Anders had grown complacent, far from it. He was still having trouble sleeping, in part because he couldn't stop worrying about the systems. Anders didn't want anyone else messing around with the instrument panel, and it seemed to him that Lovell was a little carefree about throwing switches. Once or twice, Anders was floating in his sleeping bag, unable to sleep, and heard mission control call, Apollo 8, we'd like you to switch to the secondary evaporators. Then he saw Lovell's hand reaching for the wrong switch. Anders stopped him. Jim, it's the other one. I thought you were asleep, said a surprised Lovell. Not much chance of that, Anders thought. 2 p.m., Houston time. 2 days, 7 hours mission elapsed time. 207,000 miles out. Could Jules Verne have imagined the view from Apollo 8? The Earth was so far away now that Jim Lovell could hide it behind his outstretched thumb. The feeling this evoked in the pit of his stomach was hard to convey. It was that delicious mix of exhilaration and apprehension that comes from testing yourself in dangerous conditions. No matter how nonchalant an astronaut might act, Lovell knew, that apprehension was always there. You always wondered whether the engine would work. And in particular, more so on this flight than either of his previous space missions, it was pure awe. Everything he had ever known was on that blue marble, and it was getting smaller by the moment. None of this came through in Lovell's voice just now, as he became the tour guide for the second telecast from Apollo 8. At last they had succeeded in showing the Earth to itself. The black-and-white image was only a crude facsimile of the real thing, but at least it would convey some of what it meant to be a space traveler. Lovell keyed his mic. Houston, what you are seeing is the Western Hemisphere. At the top is the North Pole, just below the center is South America, all the way down to Cape Horn. I can see Baja, California, and the southwestern part of the United States. By his own admission, Lovell was addicted to spaceflight. He'd logged 18 days on his 2 Gemini missions, more than any other astronaut. Now, in space for the 3rd time, he felt as if he'd come home again. He was glad for that familiarity. It gave him the ability to relax and absorb the experience, especially the view. Mike Collins in Mission Control asked, "Could you give me some ideas about the colors?" Lovell gave it a try. "Okay, for colors, waters are all sort of a royal blue. Clouds, of course, are bright white. The reflection off the Earth appears to be much greater than the Moon. The land areas are generally a sort of dark brownish to light brown in texture. What Lovell had seen in the past 2 days brought him an entirely new sense of scale. On Gemini, his references were continents and oceans. Now he had to think in terms of celestial bodies. The Earth was a little ball off in one direction, and the Moon in another, and the Sun still another. And then there were the stars, unmoving, unblinking landmarks along a dark and distant shore. After 2 trips into space, Lovell had come to think of them as his friends. Now, on Apollo 8, the stars were his raison d'etre. When Apollo was first conceived, it was thought that the astronauts would act not only as pilots but as onboard navigators, but the task proved so time-consuming and ate up so much space in the memory of the command module's computer that planners decided to let this work be done by computers in mission control. Still, there had to be a backup, in case Apollo 8 lost communications with Earth. In that contingency, Lovell would use the stars to help himself and his crewmates get home. With the command module's 28-power sextant, he could measure the angle between selected stars and the Earth's edge, enter the data into the computer, and let the electronic brain compute Apollo 8's location relative to the Earth and the Moon. In principle, it was the same as the shipboard navigation he'd used as a midshipman at Annapolis, but the setting was undeniably different. Already he had tested his skill with practice star sightings, and the results were within a few thousandths of a degree of perfection. Later, in lunar orbit, he would take navigation sightings on craters and other landmarks over the far side. Those data, crucial to helping craft's trajectory people analyze Apollo 8's orbit, could only be obtained by the man on board. Lovell was proud of his role on the first circumlunar voyage. Of course, none of them, himself included, was immune to the stress of the mission. The difficulty in sleeping, for example. Lovell had never slept well the first night in space, and this flight was no exception. Eventually you get over it. But he also knew that of the three of them, he probably felt the least amount of pressure. Bill Anders had the rookie's burden of doing his job while adapting to a strange environment. And like all rookies, he took his work very seriously. And Frank Borman had the heaviest burden of all. There was no doubt in Lovell's mind that command narrows one's focus, because he'd experienced that on Gemini 12. Borman's seeming uptightness, in training as well as now, was probably the commander's syndrome at work. But for Jim Lovell, who had hungered for command, there was an unexpected blessing in not getting it. He was able to enjoy the first flight around the Moon more than either of his crewmates, and it was turning out to be every bit the adventure he'd hoped. Minutes after the second telecast ended, Borman, Lovell, and Anders passed the most significant milestone since leaving Earth, and yet they were completely unaware until Houston mentioned it. Some 38,900 miles from its destination, Apollo 8 reached the top of the gravitational hill and crossed over into the lunar sphere of influence. At that moment, Apollo 8 was traveling only 2,223 miles per hour, but in mission control, craft's flight controllers saw the craft begin to speed up. But Borman's crew felt nothing. They saw no change in the visible universe. Outside, there was the same dull, starless black. To Bill Anders, the lack of tangible milestones made the voyage seem even longer. At one point, Capcom Jerry Carr asked what they could see, and Anders replied, "Nothing. It's like being on the inside of a submarine." The Moon itself was nowhere to be seen. Anders had looked forward to watching it grow ever larger as they closed in, until it became a huge, cratered ball in the sky like a science fiction vision. But he had not seen the Moon once on the whole trip out, not even a glimpse. Because of their angle of approach, the Moon was lost in the Sun's glare. It was an act of faith even to convince himself that when they arrived, the Moon would really be there. Anders thought of the Moon as his specialty. Before the flight, Borman was so involved with the journey that he had neither the time nor the inclination to worry about the destination. Lovell, who had his tracking tasks, had spent time familiarizing himself with lunar landmarks, but of the three, Anders had the most chance to think about and study the moon. Geologist astronaut Jack Schmidt had spent many hours with him going over features of interest, and he'd met with other geologists about the observations and photographs he would try to obtain. Anders had his own personal flight plan for the 20 hours he would spend in lunar orbit. Anders still remembered how, years before, he and the rest of the 14 had visited Kitt Peak National Observatory in Arizona, where they saw the moon's forbidding face, that place where he longed to walk, projected onto a large white table. But even then, blurred by the churning desert air, it was not fully revealed. He could only guess what it would be like to see it up close, with only a window in the way. Unfortunately, the windows on Apollo 8 were in pretty bad shape. The largest ones were clouded because of a sealing compound that had partially decomposed in the vacuum of space. Anders's side window looked as if it had been smeared with an oily rag. Only the two small, forward-looking viewports on either side of the hatch, the so-called rendezvous windows, had stayed relatively clear. Anders wondered how much he'd be able to see of the moon when they got there. He didn't have long to wait. Tuesday, December 24th, 2:55 a.m., Houston time. 2 days, 20 hours, 4 minutes mission elapsed time. One of the paradoxes of Apollo 8 was that the three men on their way to the moon were far less able to determine their status than the flight controllers on Earth. For all Borman's worries about whether Apollo 8 was staying on the free return trajectory, there was absolutely no way for him to find out except to ask Mission Control. Kraft's trajectory specialists were able to detect tiny changes in Apollo 8's path by measuring the Doppler shift in its radio signals. In principle, it was the same as the change in pitch that a stationary listener hears from a passing train. Even a tiny change in the frequency of Apollo 8's signals meant something to Kraft's people. Their data was so good that when they plotted the curve, you could see a little wiggle in it due to the spacecraft's slow thermal control spin. And they had nothing but good news. The trajectory was nearly perfect. Only two minor mid-course corrections had been necessary so far, and it looked as though Apollo 8 would get to the moon without making any more. The perfect marksman's shot that everyone had hoped for was about to happen. Meanwhile, a constant stream of telemetry beamed from Apollo 8 to Earth was picked up by the giant radio dishes of the manned spaceflight network, then transmitted across landlines and via satellites to Houston, where an army of flight controllers kept watch on hundreds of different components. Borman was amazed at how much they could tell about his spacecraft more than 200,000 miles away. He had no idea, for example, whether the fuel lines in the SPS engine were as warm as they should be or frozen solid, but the systems people did, and their reports were terrific. The fuel cells were functioning even better than expected. The computer was running like clockwork. There was plenty of maneuvering fuel left. Borman had wanted a perfect spacecraft before he'd commit to the lunar orbit insertion burn, and now he had it. Jerry Carr radioed the word to Apollo 8. "You're go for LOI. You're riding the best bird we can find." With characteristic caution, Borman had already turned the spacecraft to the precise orientation for the burn. In fact, he had done it 2 hours ahead of time. The moment of truth, the crucial lunar orbit insertion burn, would come when Borman's crew was out of radio contact, with only themselves and their machine to rely on. If the firing went as planned, this radio blackout would last 45 minutes, but if there was a malfunction and Borman decided to abort the mission, Apollo 8 would come around a good bit sooner than that. In Mission Control, Kraft's trajectory people would know how things had gone simply from the moment they picked up Apollo 8's telemetry. Strapped in their couches, Borman and his crew waited out the last minutes of a 3-day journey. Each of the three astronauts knew they were cutting it very close to aim nearly a quarter of a million miles across space to a world 2,160 miles across, zip just ahead of its leading edge, and go into orbit just 69 miles from its surface. The joke around the simulator was, wait till you see the 70-mile-high mountain on the far side of the moon, 69 out of 234,000. Left very little room for error. It was understandable that Borman's crew wanted something more than numbers to assess the accuracy of their path. Before the flight, the trajectory people had told them that they would not be able to see the moon as they came in, deprived of the one seat-of-the-pants method a pilot has. Eyeballing the target, they asked for something else. There was one answer, and it was loss of signal. LOS, as it was called, was the moment when Apollo 8 would slip behind the moon and lose radio contact with Earth. Once the craft was on its way to the moon, the controllers would be able to predict the time of LOS down to the second. If it happened precisely as Mission Control predicted, Borman's crew would know that all the calculations were right after all. 1 minute to LOS, advised Carr. As he spoke, the mission clock read 68 hours, 57 minutes, 4 seconds. 10 seconds to LOS, Carr radioed. Your go all the way. Thanks a lot, troops, Anders said. We'll see you on the other side, added Lovell. Borman watched the mission clock intently. At precisely 68 hours, 58 minutes, and 4 seconds, he and Lovell and Anders heard static in their headsets. He could hardly believe it, right to the second. He said aloud, "That was great, wasn't it? I wonder if they turned it off." Anders laughed. He could just imagine Kraft saying, "No matter what happens, turn it off." The men were running through the checklist for the burn when suddenly the spacecraft was enveloped by darkness. Anders realized they were deep in the shadow of the moon. As his eyes adapted, he saw that the sky was full of stars, so many he could not recognize constellations. He craned toward the flat glass to look back over his shoulder, where they were headed, and he noticed a distinct arc beyond which there were no stars at all, only blackness. All at once, he was hit with the eerie realization that this hole in the stars was the moon. The hair on the back of his neck stood up. "Come on, Anders," he told himself. "You're not supposed to feel this way." 3. In the Beginning. Tuesday, December 24th, 3:53 a.m., Houston time. 2 days, 21 hours, 2 minutes mission elapsed time. Falling in darkness, Apollo 8 was pulled toward its rendezvous with the moon at more than 5,000 miles per hour. The spacecraft was turned so that its big SPS engine pointed forward into the direction of flight. Borman, Lovell, and Anders would need every bit of its power because Apollo 8 would have to slow down in a hurry, or else speed right past its goal. It would take just 4 minutes to slow Apollo 8 to about 3,700 miles an hour, slow enough to go into orbit. Inside the command module, Borman's crew set to work, running through the checklist to bring the SPS engine to life. With 10 minutes to go, rapid-fire conversation in the jargon-rich language of spaceflight buzzed in the command module cabin as Anders called off to Borman each item on the checklist. Translation control power on. On. Rotational hand controller number 2 armed. Armed. Okay, stand by for the primary TVC check. About 3 minutes before the scheduled ignition, Apollo 8 suddenly flew into sunlight once more. Lovell glanced through the hatch window and said, "Hey, I got the moon." Borman asked, "Do you?" "Right below us." Anders looked up from his checklist at his smeared window. It looked as if streams of oil were descending slowly across the glass. "Damn it," he thought. "Whatever that stuff is, now it's running down the window." But then his eyes refocused, and he realized he was looking at mountains. They moved slowly past, lit by the slanting rays of the sun, trailing long black shadows. The mountains of the moon. He said quietly, "Oh, my God." "What's wrong?" Borman said anxiously.
Look at that. All right, come on, Borman said. You're going to look at that for a long time. With seconds to go, the computer gave its flashing 99 message, and Lovell pushed the proceed button in response. 4 seconds later, the engine lit, pressing the men into their couches. They heard a clattering noise as a stray piece of gear fell to the cabin floor. Slowly, acceleration mounted. There was no noise at all, just a gentle vibration and a smooth, steady push. Even though they were held in their couches with just a fraction of normal gravity, after 3 days in weightlessness, it felt like 3 G's. Anders scanned the gauges. Tank pressures, valve positions, fuel quantities. Pressures are coming up nicely, he told Borman. Everything is great. Time seemed to slow down. Each man knew the engine must fire for the prescribed duration. No more, no less. If the engine shut down prematurely, or if it didn't deliver the proper amount of thrust, they could end up in a weird errant orbit. If it fired even a few seconds too long, Apollo 8 would lose so much energy that it would crash into the moon. By the 2-minute mark, the burn had begun to seem very long. Borman said aloud, Jesus, 4 minutes? Longest 4 minutes I ever spent, Lovell said as the engine roared silently in the vacuum. 2 more minutes passed without mishap, and then Anders counted down the last few seconds. Borman knew the computer was programmed to shut down the engine automatically, but he wasn't taking any chances. At zero, he pushed the shut-off button just in case. Shut down, Borman said. Suddenly, they were weightless once more. Okay, Borman sighed. Go ahead. They ran through their deactivation checklist like clockwork. Lovell queried the computer for the dimensions of their orbit. They were circling the moon in an ellipse that ranged from 69 miles at a point above the far side to 194 miles at the opposite point above the near side. A little over 4 hours from now, at the start of the third orbit, Borman's crew would fire one more 11-second blast to change their path into a 69-mile circle. For now, the SPS had done its work beautifully. Within a few tenths of a mile, the orbit was perfect. That's it, Anders said. Dig out the flight plan. Apollo 8 drifted above the far side of the moon while 3 visitors looked down at a scene of total desolation. It appeared devoid of color, apart from various shades of gray. With no atmosphere to soften the view, it was a scene of unreal clarity. If they hadn't known, the men would not have been able to tell whether the moon was 69 miles away or 6. Everywhere there were craters, smooth, round bowls, misshapen gouges, gentle hollows, tiny BB-shot holes in the gray moon, shoulder to shoulder, one on top of another. Large craters bore on their ancient walls the scars of smaller craters. Every so often a lonely mountain rose from the bleakness, its slopes rounded and pockmarked. Everything else, every rise and fall of the landscape, was formed from the rim or the shoulder or the floor of a crater. The place looked like the deserted battlefield of the final war. "Whew, well, we answered it," said Borman with a laugh. They're meteorites, aren't they? It looks like a big beach down there, Anders said. That's what it reminded him of, beach sand darkened by the cold embers of bonfires, churned up by a big game of volleyball, but now deserted. Lovell, meanwhile, got out the map and tried to figure out where they were. That wasn't easy. They were over a part of the moon where the sun was almost directly overhead, and the moonscape was without definition, like a bleached, rocky ocean. Finally, Lovell spotted a huge crater with a dark floor, like a mountain lake. That was Tsiolkovsky Crater, named for the Russian scientist who had dreamt of spaceflight over a century before. Lovell knew it as soon as he saw it. Minutes later, Apollo 8 crossed over onto the lunar near side. It took several tries for Anders to make contact with Earth, but once the high-gain antenna locked onto the signal, it was amazing how clearly Jerry Carr's voice came through, as if he were somewhere nearby. And after Lovell passed down the essential data on the burn, Carr spoke for a curious world. What does the old moon look like from 60 miles? Okay, Houston, Lovell radioed. The moon is essentially gray. No color. Looks like plaster of Paris. Or a beach, Anders prompted. Or a sort of a grayish beach sand. We can see quite a bit of detail. Frank Borman did not join his crewmates in their excited descriptions. He was more concerned with the health of his engine. In Houston, the engineers were poring over strip charts of data from the burn. Borman wanted to know as soon as possible what they found out, and he wanted Mission Control to give him a go-ahead for each new orbit. Otherwise, he would prepare to leave. Let Lovell and Anders rhapsodize about the moon, Borman thought. I've got to think about getting us back. Seen from Earth on December 24th, the moon was a ripening crescent. Most of the near side was in darkness, but that meant that almost all of the moon's hidden face, never before seen by human eyes, was in sunlight. Inside Apollo 8, Bill Anders manned a pair of Hasselblad still cameras and a 16mm movie camera, his goal to record on film as many lunar mysteries as possible. His photography plan was packed with objectives, and Anders had gotten to work minutes after Apollo 8 reached orbit. When Borman, like any tourist, asked to take a picture, Anders became the rigid one. He didn't want to take any pictures that weren't in the photo plan. Now, armed with his map and his checklist, Anders scanned the parade of craters searching for his assigned targets and whatever else might look intriguing. The command module had never been designed as an observation platform, but it was turning out to be much worse than he'd anticipated. Only the two small rendezvous windows were reasonably clear, but the view through them was disappointingly restricted. It was sightseeing in a Sherman tank. To make matters worse, the best maps of the far side, drawn from unmanned probe photos, weren't that accurate. Even when he thought he knew where he was, he couldn't find anything he recognized among the swells and hollows, and when he managed to get his bearings, it was all too easy to lose track in the scramble of setting up camera gear, changing film magazines, and switching lenses. At first he hesitated to take pictures, but he decided if he was going to come home with anything, he'd better just aim the camera and fire away. By the end of the third orbit, 6 hours into the 20-hour lunar visit, he'd already taken many of the targets on his list, but there was still a lot left to accomplish. The irony was that the far side of the moon was turning out to be very different from the place he had envisioned. Like most of the astronauts, he went to see the film 2001 A Space Odyssey when it opened in the fall of 1968, and somehow, through the weeks of training, poring over the unmanned probe pictures, it was still Arthur C. Clarke's moon that stayed in his mind, a place of drama, with towering, sharp-edged mountains, cliffs, and cracks. Instead, he'd come nearly a quarter of a million miles to see dirty beach sand. It was a place of such unrelenting sameness, crater upon crater, hill upon battered hill, that to see it with his own eyes was almost an anticlimax. Anders realized, with some disappointment, that the moon was a less interesting world than he had imagined. 10:37 a.m. Perhaps it is true that our most electrifying experiences are the ones that take us by surprise. Even on the first flight around the moon, in which everything was figured to the second, rehearsed in painstaking detail, an event that no one anticipated became the most moving of all. Apollo 8 was drifting over the far side for the fourth time. Borman prepared to turn the spacecraft so that Lovell would be able to sight the moon through the command module sextant. All right, Borman announced. We're going to roll. He nudged the hand controller, and the craft turned slowly until it was right side up. When the maneuver was finished, Anders glanced out the window. Oh, my God! Look at that picture over there. What is it? Borman asked. The Earth coming up. Wow, is that pretty! Slowly, beyond the bleached horizon, a radiant half-circle of blue and white emerged, ascending into the black sky. Hey, don't take that, it's not scheduled, Borman said, seizing the chance to give Anders some grief about a picture that wasn't in the photo plan. Anders wasn't listening. He called urgently to Lovell. "Hand me that roll of color, quick, would you?" But Lovell was already joining them at the windows.
"Oh, man, that's great!"
"Hurry, quick!" Anders said. At last he slapped on the color magazine and aimed the camera with its telephoto lens. Lovell was impatient. "You got it? Take several of them. Here, give it to me." After telling Lovell to calm down, Anders snapped the picture. "Are you sure we got it now?" asked Lovell urgently.
"Yeah, it'll come up again, I think," Anders said dryly.
The first witnesses to an Earthrise returned to their work, each carrying the impact of the sight. For his part, Anders had been so focused on photographing, observing, and describing the moon since they arrived that it had not occurred to him to look at the Earth. When it suddenly appeared, his overwhelming impression was how beautiful it was, even more so beside the barren face of the moon, and how very small. 12:30 p.m. Apollo 8 had been in lunar orbit for more than 8 hours, and Borman was in need of sleep. He left Anders in charge of the systems while Lovell attended to his landmark tracking. Here, too, the computer did amazing things. Once Lovell had determined Apollo 8's position and entered it into the computer, he had only to give it the coordinates of the next target, and the sextant automatically swung to the right place. It even moved to track the landmark, compensating for the spacecraft's swift motion. The results were breathtaking. He felt as if he were flying only a few miles above the surface. Peering down into craters, he spotted landslides, even a few boulders. To his surprise, he found he could see detail even in the shadows. If Anders found the moon less intriguing than he'd hoped, Jim Lovell did not share his disappointment. Lovell's most important target lay on the near side in the eastern region of the Sea of Tranquility. There, mission planners had picked out a possible site for the first lunar landing. One of the main objectives of the mission was to reconnoiter East 1, as it was called, from orbit. Lovell had studied the approach that a lunar module would make before landing and had picked out landmarks along the way. Some of them, the ones that had been discovered on the unmanned probe photos, had no names, and Lovell, following the explorer's prerogative, had named them. Now, as Apollo 8 flew over the Sea of Tranquility, Lovell was pleased to find the familiar craters and mountains so easy to recognize. Over East 1, Lovell searched for boulders and other potential obstacles to a descending lunar module and found none. The lighting conditions were even better than he expected. It seemed a fine place for a team of astronauts to try to land. With only 69 miles between himself and the moon, Lovell wished he were making the journey. Christmas Eve, Timber Cove, Texas. As night fell outside Houston, Marilyn Lovell left her home, got into her car, alone, and headed for St. John's Episcopal Church. Knowing she would be too busy to attend the scheduled Christmas Eve Mass, she had arranged with Father Raish for a private service. She needed this, especially after the ordeal of yesterday afternoon. Even before her husband left Earth, Marilyn Lovell's life had become an emotional roller coaster. She was the only one of the three Apollo 8 wives who decided to witness the launch personally, and she had packed up her 4 children, from teenage Barbara to little Jeffrey, not quite 3 years old, and headed to Cape Kennedy, where a friend had arranged accommodations on the beach. 2 nights before the launch, Jim had found time to stop by for a visit, and the two of them had driven out to see that magnificent rocket, ablaze in floodlights, that would propel him to the moon. He'd explained to her what the launch would look like, that the Saturn would veer off to one side as it lifted off, to avoid hitting the launch tower. She thanked God that she had known what to expect, otherwise it would have scared her to death. He'd seemed so confident that night, so excited, so ready to